From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. An emotional ceremony in France today commemorated the 75th anniversary of D-Day. At a cemetery near Omaha Beach, President Trump delivered a speech to honor all those who fought at Normandy, saving Europe from the Nazis. At one point, the president turned to applaud a handful of surviving World War II veterans sitting behind him.
The lives that they gave, the sacrifice that they made, did not just win a battle. It did not just win a war. Those who fought here won a future for our nation. They won the survival of our civilization. And they showed us the way to love, cherish, and defend our way of life for many centuries to come. Today, as we stand together upon this sacred earth, we pledge that our nation will forever be strong and united. We will forever be together. Our people will forever be bold. Our hearts will forever be loyal. And our children and their children will forever and always be free. May God bless our great veterans. May God bless our allies. May God bless the heroes of D-Day. And may God bless America. Thank you. Thank you very much.
French President Emmanuel Macron also spoke at the D-Day ceremony.
We know what we owe to you, veterans, our freedom. On behalf of my nation, I just want to say thank you.
Today's remembrances marked a second day of events to honor the D-Day anniversary. Yesterday, President Trump read from a prayer that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivered on the radio on the eve of D-Day in 1944. Here's a bit of the original.
With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil.
FDR from 75 years ago, as the Allies remember D-Day today.
Back in the States, in Missouri yesterday, a judge heard arguments and will now decide the fate of the last Planned Parenthood clinic in the state. Missouri's Department of Health hasn't renewed the license of the St. Louis clinic, citing safety concerns. But abortion rights advocates say this is part of a larger campaign to eliminate legal abortion in the state. We're going to hear from many voices on the abortion debate, but today, a doctor across the border from Missouri in Illinois who's preparing for the Missouri clinic to close. Dr. Erin King runs the Hope Clinic for Women in Granite City, Illinois. Dr. King, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And when you say you're preparing, what do you mean by that?
So over the last few years, and then particularly over the last few months, we've been increasing the number of doctors, the number of nurses, the amount of time that we're open, and really trying to be as accessible as possible as more and more restrictions have passed in Missouri around abortion, and particularly in the last couple months as we knew that Missouri was about to pass a pretty restrictive ban on abortion in the state. And then really in the last couple of weeks as we've learned that they're trying to eliminate the last freestanding clinic providing abortion care in the state, we've really ramped up those efforts a lot here.
Because why? Are you seeing, I mean, even before, you say in the last couple of months, so had you been seeing women cross the border?
Oh, absolutely. So over half of our patients come from Missouri just because of our proximity to Missouri. And just in the last year to year and a half, we've seen an increase by about 30%. And then in the last couple of months, that has increased even more.
You know, what do you say to people who think that abortion's being used, let's say, as birth control, you know, flippantly, mm-hmm. some people having, you know, several of them just to get rid of unwanted pregnancies? What do you hear from women who come in?
So I'm a gynecologist, and I've been practicing medicine for over 15 years, and I have specifically trained in women's health care to provide the care that my patients need. And I really strongly believe that, you know, patients that need access to abortion at that time in their life that they're seeking care, they know their bodies best. They know their lives best. Abortion is a very personal subject. And these are not decisions that people make lightly. These are decisions that people make in a well-informed, well-thought-out process.
Can you possibly talk about what some of the emotions are that you encounter, or some of the reasons?
Right. So the emotions that we see in abortion care, you know, range from grief. There's people who, with very highly desired pregnancies, that find out that their pregnancies just can't continue. There's patients that have severe medical problems that they know that if they continue the pregnancy, that will be a detriment to their health. There are patients who come to us with relief because they know that if they continue their pregnancies, that from an economic situation, they cannot continue to take care of the children that they already have. We see patients that are conflicted. They don't know. This is a pregnancy that potentially they would continue in a different situation, but at this point in their lives, whether it's that they have a partner that's not supportive, a family that's not supportive, we see that as well. We see patients who come to us that have been assaulted, and this pregnancy is a result of that. So we really literally see 3,000 to 4,000 patients a year, and every single patient has a different reason that they are here, and they are all very, very good reasons.
When you say you see women who are conflicted, you know, there are people who say, well, that's the exact reason that women who seek an abortion, people who may even want it to remain legal, but feel that there should be counseling.
So there are very, very good studies that show that by the time people actually arrive to a healthcare facility for an abortion procedure, over 95% of them have made a clear choice. And I don't want people to think that when they get to our office, they necessarily suddenly have to have their procedure. We absolutely have educators, counselors here that talk to the patients, ask them about their decision, make sure that they do not feel forced in any way, that this is a decision that they are making. Most of the time, people know their bodies. They have talked to their own families, their own partners about this decision before they even walk through the doors to see me.
You said Missouri passed a law banning abortions after 8 weeks. Doctors could face 15 years in prison for violating that ban. In Alabama, the new law there would punish doctors with up to 99 years in prison. Now, that's if these laws take effect. If these laws do take effect, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, will you stop?
So we, as doctors, our job is to take care of our patients in a way that is legal for the patient and for ourselves. So I think the biggest concern for us is the wording around criminalization for the patient themselves as well. This is becoming a very dangerous part of healthcare for the patients and then for the doctors that provide it. So I don't think any of the doctors plan to do illegal procedures on the patients, but we just don't want to see our patients seeking care outside the health system where they could be criminalized as well.
Look, your state, Illinois, just did the opposite of what many of the surrounding states are doing. The state just approved a bill declaring abortion a fundamental right. But you know the climate that you're working in right now. You mentioned the protesters outside your clinic. Do you worry about your safety?
Yes, I do worry about the safety of myself, my family, the providers in general, the employees at the facility that where we work. With the language and the rhetoric that is being used by anti-abortion people, I think has really ramped up the level of anxiety on all sides, and then therefore has ramped up the level of potential violence. If people think that I am doing some sort of medically inaccurate procedure that's described by legislators or even our president, then of course they're going to be more angry. Of course they're going to be more violent. I mean, like I said, abortion is very personal, and that is okay. It is okay for each person to have their opinion about abortion. But what really matters is trusting the patient, trusting the doctors, and trusting a system where a state can say, look, we will oversee these doctors just like we oversee the rest of the doctors in our state. The medical care that they're giving will be safe for the patients seeking that care, and it will be legal and it will be accessible.
Dr. Erin King, she runs the Hope Clinic for Women in Granite City, Illinois. Dr. King, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're hearing from many voices in the abortion debate. Next week, an African-American Democratic state rep from Louisiana who backs anti-abortion legislation and says the procedure is genocide against her people.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
Negotiations continue today between the U.S. and Mexico in an effort to avoid tariffs. President Trump vowed to put on all imports from Mexico if that country fails to stop the flow of immigrants crossing the U.S. border. It's the latest tariff threat aimed at a key trading partner. Today, while in Ireland, Trump threatened more tariffs on China. Joining us now is Adam Posen, president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He also served on the panel of economic advisors to the U.S. Congressional Budget Office for seven terms. Adam, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
How would you describe the strength of the U.S. economy right now, given the trade wars that are going on?
The trade wars are eating away at the underlying strength of the U.S. economy, even though it hasn't thrown us much off track yet. It's hitting particular states and regions, particular industries very hard. The agricultural industries are being hit very hard. That means farmers throughout the country. Everybody who uses steel and aluminum is being hit, and there's 40 jobs in the using steel and aluminum for every one that's in those industries. Consumers haven't yet been hit quite as hard, but they will be when the next round of China tariffs, and if the Mexico tariffs go through, it'll start being on consumer products in a meaningful way.
And earlier this week, we heard from the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, about how the economy is doing amid the trade tensions. He said the Fed will work to maintain economic growth amid uncertainty. Here he is.
I'd first like to say a word about recent developments involving trade negotiations and other matters. We do not know how or when these issues will be resolved. We are closely monitoring the implications of these developments for the U.S. economic outlook. And, as always, we will act as appropriate to sustain the expansion with a strong labor market and inflation near our symmetric 2% objective.
So a lot of people took from that that he may cut interest rates this year. How much power do you think the Fed has right now over the economy?
I was sitting right there when Chair Powell said this, and I think people massively overinterpreted it, the stock market in particular. This is a statement just acknowledging as far as you can without politically challenging the president that the tariffs, if continuing to escalate, especially the new kind of tariffs being threatened on Mexico, could really forestall growth, could be a problem. But the reality is the Fed is going to have to wait to see how the tariffs work out, what their effect is on the economy. Effectively, they have to wait to see the damage before they can react. It's like with a tax cut. They can't work in anticipation of a political act. That's beyond their mandate. Mm-hmm. Their capability of acting is a little more limited now, too, than it used to be, partly because of changes Congress made after the crisis, and partly because interest rates are very low, so they can't cut that much.
So you wouldn't expect a cut this year?
I think there could be a cut this year, but I think it's far less likely than the markets are pricing in. I wouldn't take it for granted. The U.S. is a big closed economy, and when you have already easy monetary policy and very loose fiscal policy, that covers a lot of sins. So we could erode our investment, harm consumers, but still not have something the Fed has to react to.
I want to talk to you about the housing market, because one of the things that's happened as the trade tensions have heated up is that investors have fled to bonds and the interest rates have come down and mortgage rates have started to come down. And yet there doesn't appear to be that much of a boost for the housing market given all of that. What do you think is going on with the U.S. housing market?
I think there's two things going on with the U.S. housing market, Jeremy. I mean, one is a long-term thing since the crisis, which I know your program has reported on, that there are a lot of people with outstanding student debt, fear of past turmoil, insecurity about their jobs. They're just less willing to take on the risk and obligation of a mortgage. But there's also a short-term fact, which is that uncertainty has genuinely shot up in the last couple months, thanks to the president's trade war with China, thanks to his extending the trade war with Mexico despite having signed an agreement. And people are realizing that.
I want to ask you one more question, because President Trump has been using economic power to try to deal with foreign policy issues, not just in the trade war with China and Mexico and Europe and other places, but also with sanctions on places like Iran, like Venezuela, and like North Korea. Do you think that that has been an effective strategy to use the economic might of the U.S. in that way?
I think it's been completely ineffective and backfired. We know that sanctions work if they're very targeted, if you have the allies on board so that other countries don't get the target country around the sanctions, and when you have a very specific goal. So like the Iran sanctions made sense because it was about specifically Iran's nuclear program, and it was in line with the allies, so there was no smuggling around it or very little. These kinds of tying to allies like Mexico or Japan or Germany, economic warfare just overextends the U.S. and it's just not going to work. And even with China, I'm not calling them an ally by any means, but you're not going to have much effect if you're trying to change their whole economic system through a few trade measures. It's a bad strategy.
That's Adam Posen, who is president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we reported recently on the discovery of plastic debris in one of the world's most remote places, the Mariana Trench, which extends 7 miles deep beneath the ocean surface in the western Pacific near Guam, a place long thought pristine, untouched by pollutants. But researchers also found plastic microbeads in every little crustacean they tested from the trench. And now they've found radioactive material from nuclear detonations, so-called bomb carbon, in the same sea creatures. Adam Levy writes about it all in Scientific American. He joins us by Skype. Adam, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
And we know that scientists have been able to trace the reach of these detonations since, practically since they first began in 1945. And so remind us, they do this by measuring levels of carbon?
Yes, so carbon-14 exists naturally in the atmosphere. It's a radioactive version of carbon. But over the 1950s, the 1960s, thanks to thermonuclear bomb tests, the levels of carbon-14 in the atmosphere doubled. Since then, it's gradually been spreading around the world, into the oceans, into life, including us.
Well, and there's also residue from the explosion at Chernobyl and Fukushima's nuclear disaster. So there's that as well. But talk about what was found in the Mariana Trench and how researchers responded to this.
So they looked at these shrimp-like crustaceans, which live right at the bottom of the ocean. We're talking miles deep. Mm. If it was just thanks to the ocean current, it would probably take this extra bomb carbon about 1,000 years to reach this point. But living animals, when they die, they fall to the bottom of the ocean. And when they poop, that poop goes to the bottom of the ocean. And the organisms at the bottom of the ocean eat that. And in the process, they have also absorbed some of this bomb carbon, this carbon-14, from our nuclear tests in the middle 20th century.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I love when you speak scientifically about poop and such things that are floating to the bottom and being eaten by these crustaceans. But that's how it got there so fast. I mean, this, it sounds like, was a stunning revelation.
Well, I think a lot of researchers might have expected it to get there because, you know, it's been everywhere else. And we know that, you know, things near the surface of the ocean fall down. It's still sad to see it there. It's sad to have that suspicion confirmed and see that, yes, this signature from our nuclear tests has made it to such a far-flung part of the world.
Well, it's a reminder of how the food chain works, because the bomb carbon had been spread around the world. You know, it's taken up by the carbon dioxide of plants. Plants are then eaten by animals. Animals, you know, include humans. So you remind us that this is in the food chain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this bomb carbon has actually been used to put a date on the age of living tissue, including human tissue, and see kind of how different parts of the human body age at different rates. So it really is everywhere, including ourselves.
Well, it's in things like glaciers. How will that be impacted as glaciers are melting?
Yeah, so there's signatures not just from these nuclear bomb tests, but also from the fallout, as you mentioned, of Chernobyl and Fukushima nuclear disasters. So in this case, there are actually quite dangerous nuclear contaminants in glaciers. And as the world warms up, these glaciers will retreat. These chemicals will then be released.
Talk about the wider meaning of finding this so-called bomb carbon in these little shrimp at the, you know, 7 miles deep into what was thought was pristine environment, and in glaciers also thought at one time to be pristine, but now locked in there and to be released by global warming. What's the wider meaning of this?
Well, every single person I spoke to said that this idea that there's some pristine place on the planet which we haven't touched, that is safe from us, that isn't affected by us at all, this idea doesn't really hold water. Wherever we look, there's our fingerprints all over it. One of the researchers I spoke to found plastic in the bottom of the ocean in the Mariana Trench. He described his own work as the saddest piece of research I've ever been involved with. That's William Reed. That kind of captures a lot of the emotion around this, because they're these places which we think of as kind of magical and so far away, and yet wherever we look, there we are.
In fact, some are saying that humans have created a new age, a new geological epoch.
Yeah, so this epoch some are calling the Anthropocene. It's nothing to be proud of, unfortunately, but it is as this idea that we've changed the world so much that you can see that geologically. And actually, studies like this kind of add weight to that. One of the ideas around the Anthropocene is that the nuclear testing of the mid-20th century ushered in a kind of definite point when the Anthropocene began. And now we're seeing that nuclear materials from that are reaching the bottom of the ocean. It kind of adds weight to that idea that the whole world was affected by humans at that point and beyond.
That's Scientific American writer Adam Levy. We'll link you to his article, Bomb Carbon Has Been Found in Deep Ocean Creatures, in Scientific American at hereandnow.org. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It's playoff season in basketball. The Toronto Raptors lead the Golden State Warriors 2-1 after the Raptors' 123-109 win last night. Wait, what? Canadians may be better at basketball? And in hockey Stanley Cup final, the St. Louis Blues and Boston Bruins are tied at 2 wins apiece. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, Steph Curry scored 47 points last night, a career playoff high, but it's just not enough.
It's not enough, and he has gone from just the greatest second scoring option in the history of the NBA with a healthy Kevin Durant to can't do it himself when you have so many injuries. So Kevin Durant is out for, has been out for the season so far. He could come back, but every game we wait and the Warriors say, no, he won't be playing. And before this, game three, Klay Thompson, who is Steph Curry's co-splash brother, he was ruled out. He was hoping that he could come back, but they held him out maybe for one game and he'll be back in game four. And even though the Warriors have an amazing cadre of players, once you take them away, and then some players who don't maybe fill up the box score, like Kevon Looney, who is just a great center, it becomes too much against a really good, what we're realizing is a really good Raptors team filled with, by the way, no Canadians.
I know.
Just want you to know that.
I know. But the country in which they are playing is Canada. So yeah, they have, I think that you're saying what people are thinking, they're better than people thought.
I think that people more overrated the Warriors. And if you look at the betting odds, it went in these weird ways where the Warriors were actually favored, or I should say they were the underdogs in game one. And yet for the whole series going into the series, they were like a 75% chance to win. And then even after the Raptors won the first game, those series odds didn't budge. But just now with the Raptors having really crushed the Warriors and the Warriors' injuries presenting themselves, the Raptors are pulling even in the odds to win the whole series in Las Vegas.
To hockey, game five between the Bruins and the Blues tonight. Can anyone win this?
Yes, they will have to, as are the rules. So it's 2-2. These teams have different strengths, but with the exception of one of the games have all been hard fought, as they say. And yeah, this does have the hallmarks of a great seven-game series. Mm-hmm. So far, it's been extremely exciting.
Yeah, it has been. Soccer. I just want to mention the World Cup begins tomorrow with host nation France playing South Korea. But the woman who's regarded as the best player in the world, we just want to mention Norway's Ada Hegerberg, Ada Hegerberg. She is not playing. Why not?
It's not 100% clear, but it is a conflict between her and the Norwegian Soccer Federation that seems to rest in issues of her criticism over equality and the role of women or how women are treated by at least the Norwegian Federation. But I think the greatest chance for an upset to the United States winning this thing, which mm-hmm. and they are the favorites, is the home country, France. And mm-hmm. it's weird because in men's soccer, the home team has won 6 World Cups. But in women's soccer, it only happened once. And if you cast your mind back, you probably remember it. It was when the United States won in Pasadena in the famous World Cup where the sports bra was
They took off
revealed.
Their shirts.
Yes. Well,
why not? You guys do it all the time. Okay, so we will be watching World Cup
I don't.
Soccer. That's not what they say, Mike.
Ah,
Mike
yes.
Pesca, here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
All right.
We got the sad news this week from public radio station KCRW in Santa Monica that longtime jazz DJ Bo Leibowitz died on Monday at the age of 74. For 40 years, Bo hosted the Strictly Jazz program on the station, sharing the music he loved with Southern California listeners. And with us, he took part in several of our DJ sessions, most recently in May of last year. We started by talking about the name of his longtime show, Strictly Jazz.
Actually, the derivation of the name stems from the fact that the station is known for its eclectic
right.
qualities, the flagship show being
Morning Becomes Eclectic. Right.
So it was more, and I didn't even choose the name, it was something before me, but it was to distinguish it because everything else is eclectic, so we wanted to let them know this is just strictly jazz.
Okay, well, let's get to some of the jazz. This
okay.
is the German-born pianist Monika Herzig with 4CC. So tell us about this one.
It's written by the bass player, Jennifer Vincent. In fact, the name of the disc is She Rose, and it's an all-female band. But what I like about this particular track for CC is that it has two pairs of instruments that introduce the song. First, the bass and the piano sort of work in tandem to provide the rhythmic backdrop, and there's a sort of sense of urgency about their entrance. And then you have the flute and the trombone, which state the melody, which is rather fragmented, in unison, and then they solo over each other. So it's, I don't know, it has a very urgent feel to it that I find very satisfying.
And Monika Herzig is from Germany. She's now a professor at Indiana University. Tell us more about her.
Well, the Indiana University Jacobs School of Music is one of the finest in the country, and it was basically put together by the late David Baker, who died about a year or so ago. And in fact, Monica Herzig wrote a book about David Baker. So she's one of these people who wears many hats. She's a pianist, she's an educator, she's a writer, and she's a promoter as well.
All right, well, the next one you brought us is from Miles Davis and John Coltrane's album, The Final Tour. This is called Green Dolphin Street. It was performed live in Stockholm. Now, the final tour refers to a tour through Europe with both Davis and Coltrane. And Miles Davis wrote in his biography that John Coltrane grumbled and complained and sat by himself all the time we were over there. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, he was in the midst of forging his own career as a soloist and as a leader. And he really didn't want to go on this tour. And he and Miles had sort of, difficult relationships here and there. But they were perfect for each other. They were a great foil for each other. Miles was very contained and chose his notes carefully, and Coltrane just flooded the area with notes. I mean, he was known as sheets of sound. But anyway, Coltrane was preoccupied with his own career at the time. He had recorded Giant Steps, a monumental album for Atlantic. And this tune, Like Sonny, which was based upon a 10-second phrase that Sonny Rollins had played on a record. And you could tell that he was preoccupied. He had recorded it about 3 or 4 months before this recording of On Green Dolphin Street. And you can hear him sort of noodling around with that song that he had just recorded. And to me, it sort of epitomizes Train's position at this time in 1960 and wanting to stretch out a bit more.
Okay, well, up next, you have brought us the drummer Matt Wilson with his song Anywhere and Everywhere People.
There are people so near nothing, they are everywhere without being seen. There are people so eager to be seen, they nearly always manage to be seen. There are people who want to be everywhere at once, and they seem to get nowhere.
Would you call that singing or talking?
Well, that's definitely talking, and oddly enough, the narrator there is perhaps the greatest bass player alive today, Christian McBride, although he does not perform on the bass here, but he is one of the many narrators that Matt Wilson has used to illuminate the poems of Carl Sandburg.
And in this song, we hear a straight rock and roll beat, not the normal swing you hear in jazz.
Right, right. There's a little bit of backbeat there, but I love the way that the music sort of syncs up with the poem, emphasizing certain words and syllables. For example, the trumpet and the saxophone emphasize the word everywhere, and so it gives it some structure.
They are everywhere without being seen.
And who is Matt Wilson?
Matt Wilson is a drummer from, I believe, the Midwest to begin with, but played with a lot of good people on the East Coast, Lee Konitz in particular, I remember, and he's a very good drummer.
We have time for one more. This is So Long by Melody Gardot.
Don't wait up for me, darling, I'm not coming home. Draw the blinds and set the alarm.
beautiful voice.
Oh, yes, I really like her voice. It's so sensuous, and she has this sort of natural vibrato with this very sensuous quaver to it that reels me in every time. And that song is sort of like a Dear John letter. And it comes from a series of recordings, I believe previously unreleased, of a tour in Europe that spanned from 2012 to 2016. And she, by the way, is sort of the poster child for music therapy because she was involved in a horrible hit-and-run accident while she was riding her bike. And she was in the hospital for many, many months. And she, it was very early in her career. She had never recorded before, but she had appeared in some nightclubs in Philadelphia. But it was in that hospital stay that she really got back into the music. And that became her EP. Her initial EP was from that period. And then she just took off from there. She's wonderful.
And this may be surprising to our listeners when you listen to her voice, but she's only 33 years old.
Yeah.
She sounds, you know, she's like she's got an old soul.
Exactly, exactly. She sounds like she's been through it all.
Longtime jazz DJ Bo Leibowitz speaking with me in May of 2018. He died on Monday at the age of 74. His colleague Tom Schnabel remembered him saying, "When newspapers stopped covering jazz, Bo Leibowitz was unwavering in his commitment to the art form and devoted 40 years to honoring it."
To the YouTube controversy now, Vox journalist Carlos Maza posted a montage of homophobic comments he says right-wing YouTube commentator Steve Crowder made about him over 2 years, and Maza demanded YouTube ban Crowder. Now, we can't play the most vile part, but a warning, the following snippet is still vile.
You, by the way, the gay Mexican guy.
The gay Latino V-neck.
Gay Mexican. Or Mexican gay guy used to work. Mexican gay Latino there at Vox. Gay Latino from Vox.
The token Vox gay atheist sprite.
Commentator Steve Crowder. Now, YouTube declined to ban him as Vox journalist Carlos Maza demanded, but yesterday said they'd cut off revenue from his channel. Crowder had been selling homophobic T-shirts, among other things. He says these are jokes and he's being censored. YouTube says they're a platform, like a phone company, not a publisher like a newspaper. Oh, and did we mention it's Pride Month? And YouTube just announced a plan to block extremist language. NPR media critic David Folkenflik is here. David, your thoughts?
Well, it reminds me a little bit when I was a kid going to the Grand Canyon. You'd go down into the canyon, you'd see these paths go, and they'd switch back and forth and back and forth. YouTube initially responded to Carlos Maza's angry tweets that collected all this stuff and played far much worse vitriol than what you're able to play on today's show. And they said, look, this is hateful. This is offensive, objectionable material, but it doesn't violate our policies. We're a platform. We err very strongly on the form of free speech. Well, as he brought up pressure, as other journalists looked at it, as a lot of them teased out inconsistencies in the way in which YouTube had enacted its policies, YouTube said, we're going to demonetize him. And then they came out and said they're really going to review their harassment policies once more under increasing pressure and scrutiny, and basically sought ways to dampen Crowder's ability for the moment to amplify his message.
Well, you say for the moment because do we understand that YouTube is also saying that he might be able to monetize again if, for instance, he's not selling vile, hateful T-shirts?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening. They're saying this is the specific activity that we're going to hang our hat on. Although there were, in their latest notes about this, there were some indications that there were some unspecified issues he would also have to resolve.
Yeah, look, Crowder gave a satirical apology, then put out his own montage with left-wing comedians using off-color comedy about political figures. You know, Crowder says, if you block me, you'll have to block Stephen Colbert or Samantha Bee. But doesn't this take us to the conversation that we're also having about Facebook and, you know, other companies that are self-regulating speech? I mean, you have Mark Zuckerberg decide, I'm going to take something off Facebook, but it's still Mark Zuckerberg deciding. I mean, is this part of the broader conversation about should there be some sort of regulation here?
It is, and it's complicated because if you treat it like a platform, the company is not responsible for what happens on there. A guy like Carlos Maza looks at it and says, look, I'm not just upset that this guy is saying hateful things about me. He's encouraged his followers effectively to unleash waves of vitriol against me, sort of very abusive, hateful speech, and also doxed him, that is, published personal identifying material like his phone number. Steven Crowder's fans were texting him really abusive things as well. On the other hand, if you get into the habit of particularly using algorithms, artificial intelligence to knock out hateful and abusive speech, sometimes a lot of other speech gets caught up in that. Yeah. Certain kinds of postings that may be addressing hateful speech. So these are complicated things. And the question is, do you trust major private entities to make those choices? The federal regulators step in, then it'll be lawmakers who decide that and regulators who decide that. And there are ways in which that can work and there are ways in which that can be very problematic.
Right. It just strikes me as so interesting that if somebody were to come up, you know, to their next door neighbor and scream some of these things to their face, some of these vile homophobic things, you could call the police. That would be harassment. But you can scream at someone through social media, or at least that's what we're seeing here. And it's happening during Pride Month. YouTube has produced LGBTQ content. It's used plenty of rainbow flags in its marketing. Does Maza have a point that, hey, you're benefiting from us while you're not protecting us?
It certainly seems to have stirred him to act publicly on this now. He said this hypocrisy is too much for him to bear. And I think that, you know, people inside Google seem to have given indications that they've been troubled by the dissonance. You know, Facebook at times has acted to allow people to continue to post, but made it very hard for their work to be shared. Crowder had a very popular and has a very popular channel. So it's not only being viewed by a ton of people, but being shared by a ton of people. So there are ways and gradations in which things could be done. I think there's a question also going on is, should YouTube treat people differently given the size of their routine audience? If somebody's mouthing off to 30 people, is it different than somebody mouthing off to 3 million?
Or 4 million, which is Crowder's case. And some people say he'll be more popular now because they have cut off his revenue stream for now. And yet he gets to keep his channel and claim to be a victim. So he may have even more followers.
Well, the victimization thing has always been a popular card to play for people who are under duress. I will say that folks who have been highlighted and singled out as extremely offensive, people have been dropped from Twitter, for example, that is called deplatforming. And while I'm not necessarily advocating it or going against it, I've got to say that has been effective in dampening the audience that they reach. A guy like Milo Yiannopoulos, who for a while was able to make quite a splash at Breitbart, and afterward, when he was, you know, dropped from a couple of major social media platforms, you know, he really kind of vanished from sight.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, we will follow this story with you. Thank you.
You bet.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.